Hey, Steve, I'm so excited to have you on. Obviously, we have a long history, right? And I don't even think we could have a whole discussion about the history and all this in the time that we have. But I want to introduce you quickly in my own way because we have such a long history working together and alongside each other in different scenes. So Steve Schlafman, from my perspective, is an angel investor who runs an angel fund. He was a venture capitalist at a number of different funds in New York City. He's an executive coach. He is an advisor to a number of startups. And just alongside the tech scene that has been building and growing in New York for all this time that I've been in it, you've been a fixture and you have been one of the major people that has helped it grow. And so I'm so excited to have you on today, Steve. And I'm so excited we get to chat about all the stuff that we've learned together and all the mistakes that we've made.
Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And I'm so thrilled for your next chapter as well.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been great to do this. We've talked 100,000 times, but never in this way. And it's nice to be back in the saddle recording podcasts. And I'm excited to chat with you because there's so much that we've learned. And so tell our listeners a little bit about your history, beginning, you know, wherever you're inclined to do so, maybe with the Patriots or in venture in New York, wherever you want to begin, and how it led you to where you are today.
Yeah, I'll start with the 30,000 foot view. So I spent almost the first decade of my career as an operator in a bunch of different tech companies. The first 5 years or so was spent at Microsoft and a company called Massive, which delivered advertising into video games. I then spent about 3.5 years working for the Kraft Group. They own and operate the New England Patriots. I then spent about a little more than a year at a company called Sticky Bits, which we pivoted to Turntable.fm. And I was there running business development and because it was a technical CEO and founding team. And then I spent the last decade as a professional investor at some of the top funds in New York City, like Lair Hippo and Primary Ventures.
Yeah, amazing. And now you're running an angel fund? And you're an executive coach, and those are your sort of two primary things in 2020. How has 2020 been for you so far?
2020, as I was saying before the show, has been a really fulfilling and productive year for me, both professionally and creatively. So I decided to basically leave institutional investing for the most part last fall. So the fall of 2019, to give the listener some context. And it was a decision I had been wrestling with for well over a year because I decided to train to become a coach. I mean, amazingly, over 3.5 years ago. So I trained to become a coach while I was still an investor full time, and then ultimately decided to sort of burn the boats and step into whatever you call this new life. And so, for those listening, I run a boutique coaching and leadership development company I call High Output. Right now, I'm working with 8 to 10 clients at any given time. I wish I could work with more, but I purposely keep my practice pretty small. And then, you know, as Julian suggested, I operate and manage a small angel fund where I behave more like an advisor that invests capital as opposed to an institutional investor. Right. So what does that mean? I am fiercely supportive of the founders, with maybe the exception of illegal behavior.
Right. Yeah. I don't know how often you encounter that. We were on my board at Breather for a long time. And I remember, let me tell you what I see. And I think a lot of people see is they see a dedication and commitment when you're in. And I actually watched you go through this process around 2014 when with RRE, you led this Series A round with Breather. And I want to understand the process of belief a little bit. And how you go and what it means to believe in someone and to back them. Because one of the interesting things about your fund now, at least the last time that we discussed it, is it's not a fund that has reserves. It deliberately says we're all in from day one. And the objective of that, for those that are sort of not close to that world, is that it means that all the capital is just invested up front which means that you're immediately like you're just on the side of the founder from that part that
because
place
forward. There's no follow-on decision.
That's right. There's no further decisions. Do I need to invest again? Can I do that? Like none of those things need to happen. So it means that you're really closely allied to founders. I'm curious what it takes for you to get there with someone. It sounds to me like it's a process of learning about someone and so on. It must be similar to how you start with a coach. Tell me, with a client, tell me how you begin to believe in someone and what that takes for you to get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we can use Breather as a case study. I think you know this about me, that I tend not to obsess over the numbers and the market sizing and those where I tend to be a mission, vision, and founder-centric investor. I also think like problem-centric and customer-centric. So
right.
I really look for people that are able to paint a picture of a new future that has sort of impact customer and the problem at heart, and then are delivering a really interesting experience around that vision and insight. And so, you know, in the case of Breather, I think back, we initially met when I was investing at Lair. And I remember what I said, whereas I was like, this idea is crazy. Taylor Davidson, a mutual friend, introed us. And yes. He's like, I think Breather's crazy, but I think you're going to like it for that reason. And then we met. And, you know, for me, like, I was like, this is a wild idea, but it's such a unique idea that I need to see and touch it. And I need to feel it. Mm-hmm. And then I went, when you opened up in New York, that first, one of the first locations on the corner of Houston and Broadway in Soho.
Yeah.
And like, once I experienced it, and spent time with you, I was like, when you match the experience with, you know, you as a creative mind, it was like, okay, this is making sense. And the thing that got it for me, which was how I got to the market sizing question, was if I walk around New York City and I just see the number of buildings, I was like, every door in that city had a potential to be in the Breather network.
Yeah.
And I think it was a combination of those three things, you, your vision, the experience, and then the shared potential of the opportunity.
Is that how you choose a client now, right? Like 8 to 10 clients, that's a meaningful business from a coaching perspective. And I'm super curious because it's one of them is kind of there's scale right there. And one of them kind of coaching is there's not the same scale as Inventure for sure, right? So you really have to select those clients and you have to be careful about them. It's such a deep relationship and you have to be so deeply committed to that founder. How are you selecting those clients? What are you doing? What's your process? And then how often are you turning people away and what's your most common reasons for turning someone away?
So I've written about it on my personal blog. For those listening, you can find me at schlaf.me. Schlaf.me is my blog. So I've written about this extensively. So I typically serve three personas. The first is a venture-backed CEO who typically has more than 4 employees. So I would say call it beginning at the pre-seed stage as far up to usually about 100 employees. I think any beyond that, like I can definitely support founders beyond that stage. I have, but I love call it pre-seed to call it through Series B.
Sure.
Just I love the earliest stages. The second persona is what I call a leader in transition. So these are extremely high potential people that and could be founders that are in the midst of some sort of career life transition and helping them through that. And then the third bucket is investors. So currently out of the 8, and interestingly about investors, for a long time I resisted working with them. And then I ultimately decided that I was uniquely qualified to support investors, given that I was an institutional investor for almost a decade. So I'm currently working with two general partners of West Coast firms. And again, I got a long time. I fought that. So those
at
are
different
the
funds.
Yeah.
Different funds.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, right now I'm doing a short-term engagement, more of like a, what I call like a leadership sprint with two partners doing co-founder coaching in terms of the net, like they're going to go out and raise their next fund. And I'm working very closely with them to help them determine, do they want to move forward with a new fund?
Sure.
And how do they reinvent the fund? And so it's a mix of, I'd say there's definitely a lot of coaching embedded in that, but also strategy consulting in a really fun and interesting way. So I would say those are, that's generally who I work with. And then in terms of what I look for, you know, I look for people that are fully committed to the process and that are taking it incredibly seriously. And so when they reach out or we have that first conversation, the level of depth and thinking about why they're seeking a coach and what they want to work on, then that's really important. The other is, like, frankly, just what they're working on. You know, sure. is this something of impact, or could it be something of impact? There's another bunch of filters, which is this someone I like? Is this someone I want to root for? Is this someone I'm going to learn from? Is this someone that is going to succeed regardless of if they work with me? And so there's a whole bunch of filters that I think about when selecting clients. And to address one of your earlier questions, which is, what are the reasons I turn clients away? And I say this at the beginning of a conversation with a potential coaching partner. I'll say, look, like, here's the situation. I only have 8 to 10 slots. I'm basically at capacity. At any given time, I'm basically at capacity.
Right.
So I say to them, look, I don't view this as a sales process. Like, I very much view it as a fit process. And so if both of us are going to be making a commitment, and I don't, if you come to me and you say, Steve, this isn't a good fit, I'm going to go with another coach. You know what I'll say? Great. Because in this line of work, I very much view it as a game of abundance as opposed to a game of scarcity, where I look out and I see millions of people and creators that need coaching. And so if it's not a fit, that's okay. Because, you know, my belief is that the next one will come around. And so the reason why, you know, I won't move forward, it's, I'd say right now it's due to capacity, because I just can't, you know, like you know, I just don't have any more slots. And then the second is due to fit. And I think like fit, like a big one is also just energy. Like I had a call maybe a month ago with a founder who was looking for a coach and just did not feel their energy and their commitment. And
it's vaguely heartbreaking, because someone has to, I think, reach out. And that's like a process. I think it's maybe a little bit like going to find a therapist or something like that, where you're going, okay, I'm gonna do something I don't typically do here, and I'm gonna reach out whenever someone in the small executive coaching practice that I have. It's definitely someone reaching out, and they're like, they almost say like, I'm not typically like this, but I figured that I would, because it is still. And that's what fascinates me about your mention of coaching investors. I think that is so unique and so uncommon in finance, in venture. I'm super curious to dig into that. Do you know any, first of all, do you know any other investor coaches at all? Does that, they must exist, but I definitely don't know of any.
Yeah, I think there are some people that specialize, no, I wouldn't say specialize, but do cater to that audience. And so from what I understand, Mockery that wrote Great CEO Within, sure. I think he has some GP general partner clients.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I think Jerry Colonna.
Yeah, probably.
Given that he was also a former investor.
Yeah, and Khaled, his partner, right, as well.
Yeah, exactly. My existing coach, Chris Sparks.
Yeah.
Also, I has worked with some investors. So my friend Sunil Arora, although less venture, but more like institutional, like hedge fund type investors. So you definitely see it out there if you hang in these circles too long.
I was talking to Mark McLeod recently, and he was a early CFO for Shopify and for FreshBooks. And there's this whole discussion around how difficult it is to be able to do it alone. A lot of people view this founder mythology, which I'm sure is just like the investor mythology, of this person is perfect and they're a genius and they had an idea and then the thing took off. And only recently have people been saying, oh yeah, but actually this is super hard and it might break you. And so do you see in the background, because I think you have more of a view of the, in the background behind the curtain, so to speak, than I do. Are you seeing that a lot of these high performing people are actually much more supported than we think they are?
I think it really varies on the person, by the person. You know, I come across prospects and clients that aren't supported at all.
Right.
And then I have others that are like highly supported, whether it's through their spouse or partner or co-founders or any number of relationships. So I think it all just depends on the person. I've seen both ends of the spectrum.
And from a perspective of your coaching practice, like you said, you had only, what you started, like you said, 3.5 years ago, and it's almost like it was your side gig or something for a really long time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so how did you come to realize that this was going to be your profession? It's more your profession maybe today, or at least 50-50 alongside
angel
investing.
I would say it's more than investing right now.
How it almost feels like a funny coming out of the closet type of thing. How does that, I mean, how, what's that inner process like? It's definitely my father was a coach for 40 years, right? So I definitely, my resistance to that space comes from my resistance to him.
I can imagine.
And so, but I'm curious how you finally decided this is what I want to do. Like, this is my next chapter.
Yeah. I've written about this, in a number of blog posts, but I think the first signs of it happened when I was at RRE. So probably 2015, to give you and the audience some context. My wife is a founder and CEO of a company called The Sill. It's a direct consumer commerce brand for houseplants. Mm-hmm. And she would come home at the end of the day with, you know, a range of these issues. And it was, you know, what I like to call issues related to the inner and the outer game of entrepreneurship.
For sure.
And she, and I just found that like a number of things happened for me. One of which was I sort of began to ask myself, like, you know, obviously her experience can't be that, like, it's unique, but it's common. The other thing is that the things that she's coming with are all the people, it's all the complex aspects of running a company. And I found myself actually wondering, like, out of all the entrepreneurs I work with, being in the boardroom and just sort of regular investor updates, like, I'm not seeing this part of the business. So
sure.
That was like the first. And then I have way more friends that are founders, as you know, than investors. And it would be the same things. Like, I would get together with my buddy Irving Fain, who's the CEO of a company called Bowery Farming. And when he was the CEO of his previous company, CrowdTwist, it was like we'd have these off the record conversations about what was going on with his board and you know, and his team and all these things. And I just began to say, like, there's a lot happening that investors just aren't able to like touch.
Yeah.
And for me, I ultimately was like, this other area, this other territory is actually far more interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And B, I actually think I can have a bigger impact. And C, it gives me much more energy to have these kinds of conversations. And
for sure.
So I think it was a combination of those sorts of things. And then I'm pretty public about it. But I got sober in 2015. Yeah, I guess, because this was five years. This year was five
Congratulations.
Years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And in that process, like, service and this idea of giving back to other people is a really important part of living a sober life. And I felt that, at least for me, investing was a little too transactional.
Sure.
And I wanted to orient towards a more service-oriented type of profession. And then I would say the last reason, I know I'm sort of going on this too long, but I think the last reason is also really important, which is, and I've thought a lot about this, but if I always ask myself, like, what am I actually learning as an investor?
That's interesting.
Like, actually learning like a real skill that was useful outside our little bubble.
The little bubble, like the little venture Twitter bubble is what you're talking about?
Yeah, the venture Twitter bubble.
What am I learning about life? Is that what you mean?
Just learn, like, am I learning a skill that can be useful my whole life?
Okay, so what's and what was your conclusion?
Was no, like if the venture, let's just hypothetically say that we had another repeat of 99 and 2000 where there was this massive bubble and half the industry implodes and I'm standing on the sidelines. I was like, well, what would I even do?
After,
like, what am I?
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though I operated for 10 years and like, would I even want to do that? And like, if I were to learn a skill, what would be useful? What would give me energy? What would actually leverage my existing skill set, my network, and all these other things? And I just kept on coming back to coaching for all those reasons. And the thing that I love about coaching is that it's so multidisciplinary and that it touches on all these different disciplines, you know, everything from psychology to history to human potential to adult development theory and so on and so forth. And so for me, it's just like I can sink my teeth in this world and spend the next 20 to 30 years of my life, God willing, hopefully I live that long, and just, you know, throw myself into it and really go on the path of mastery and like really getting proficient and excellent in a specific area.
It's remarkable the amount of people that you, okay, so you become a master, okay, whatever that means, and then you're a master at coaching, and I'm curious to sort of figure out what you think that is, and then you are that, but then the scope of what you touch so relatively, it's the inverse of what you touch with investing or what you touch with operating a venture-backed company. The idea with a venture-backed company is you touch millions of people. The idea with investing is you touch indirectly in some capacity. You create scale, again, with maybe millions or at least tens of thousands or some other thing like that if you're doing the job right. Here, if you're a coach, we just talked about 8 to 10 people. It's like, what, you have like 100 clients? Like, you don't. And so it's fascinating that you're making that choice. And it has to do, I mean, I'm sure it has to do with the skill set and the fact that you're reaching those people. But what are you getting out of it? Like, what is it that you find so compelling about it? Because other people would look at, there's so many people trying to get into venture, as you know.
I know, I love venture Twitter, and I'm, right? And I'm trying to like...
You're like, get away. Try, you know, please don't create more suffering.
I think, I think a big part of it, Julian, was that I found myself sitting in a lot of meetings where I wasn't adding a lot of value. Or any value.
Meetings where you weren't adding
a lot of value. Well, it's like a 4-hour partner meeting.
Sure.
Or I'm in 5 pitches every single day hearing, and sure, like I love hearing all these ideas, but like was I using my time most effectively to like have impact on other people? And I just, for me, it's like I don't want to spend, you know, half my day, 3/4 of my day, just hearing pitches. Like it just felt
triaging. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And whereas I was like, I love the engagement with the entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the thing that I hold sacred. And where in a lot of ways, because there's not that power dynamic between being a coach, it's like you actually get more touch points. And it's a more open and trustworthy relationship. So you're actually able to go deeper and have a bigger impact.
Right.
Yeah, and to me, that's that trade-off. Now, that said, I think as we're looking to the new year, to 2021, I think the biggest thing that I'm asking myself is whether I continue down, and it's not so binary that there's like three paths in my way, but mm-hmm. I think there's a variety of paths that feel natural that I'm sensing. And one of which is to continue to do what I'm doing, where it's like mm-hmm. every few years, raise a small fund, maybe sure. start a podcast, do my 8 to 10 clients and sort of mm-hmm. have this, you know, sure. multi-career path. There's another path, which is like, I'm going to go and try to actually build a company that yeah. can, whereas like, I will still be like a coach and I will still take clients, but I'll bring in some partners to help me go and build mm-hmm. something that allows me to indirectly have a bigger impact.
Sure.
While still, so it gives me the ability to have like more of a macro impact while also continuing the one-on-one.
It's interesting. We just mentioned Jerry and his partner, and I was on the phone with him last month, I feel like. And he talked about how the early clients that he had, just due to circumstance, because he was close to Jerry Colonna, had an opportunity to be some amazing companies, some of which he named in confidence, but are stellar, incredible companies that are definitely named brands. Likewise, it feels like something is happening in coaching right now, and it feels like a lot is being built. And there's like, this is a moment right now, I feel.
Oh, I completely. I mean, you and I talk about this all the time, but mm-hmm. to me, I mean, maybe it's the fact that I've spent 20 years in technology and 10 years in venture and constantly mm-hmm. being surrounded by new ideas and the ability to look at different spaces and identify opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I just, it's like almost every single day I see new opportunities in the coaching space where it's like, huh, like as much as I respect, you know, like Reboot and Evolution and these coaching sure. organizations dedicated to serving entrepreneurs and professionals. Like I look at those and I'm like, how might you be able to do it differently? Right. Mm. And so for me, I'm always looking at this profession with a beginner's mind saying like, how can you do it? Not necessarily better, but how can you do it differently to deliver a different product and yeah. one that mm-hmm. isn't different for the sake of being different, but it's different because the market doesn't necessarily know that it needs it, but it becomes yeah. the next evolution of what one of these organizations look like. And I think there's a bunch of different flavors on like mm-hmm. what that could look like, everything from like a pure play collective where
right. yes.
it's fully, mm-hmm. fully distributed, shared infrastructure, things of that nature. And then on mm-hmm. the other end, like a more pure like coaching business with a stable sure. of coaches, but innovating mm-hmm. on the business model and the service delivery.
I mean, listen, what other white spots are you seeing? You're not going to pursue all of, okay. So there's some that you're seeing that you're not pursuing just for the benefit of our listenership. Would you mind like what are you noticing in terms of white space that someone else could take advantage of and that you do not intend to?
Yeah. I think one of which that you and I have talked about is I'm not going to reveal all my secrets. but I would say that definitely, I think there's a really big opportunity on the training, on the learning and development
right.
front. Mm-hmm. As we've talked about quite a bit. Like I just mm-hmm. see what Coaches Rising has built.
Sure.
And I really admire, like I've done a bunch of their trainings, but I just mm-hmm. think that as the coaching world becomes more and more prevalent, which I think that it will, mm-hmm. I believe that training will become more and more important. And I think the barrier to getting into coaching is like, it's a double-edged sword. Like it's right. really good, but I think there are a lot of people that would start to dip their toe in the water with, instead of taking like a 9 to 12 month course and investing 250 hours, if sure. there was like a really amazing like primer that's like a 2 month or a 3 month primer that's a quarter of the cost, and it allows you to start to. So I think there's like a bunch of opportunities in terms of like creating on ramps into the profession, but then even the continuing stuff like the Coaches Rising. I think there's just endless opportunity to build a new brand around helping people become coaches, but then, you know, be with them on that journey as they expand their skill sets. Because as we know, like, you know, if you're a coach, you never, like, at least my perspective is that you should always be learning and you always have to be leveling up. So that's definitely an opportunity. That's an opportunity that I see. I don't even want to admit how much money I'm spending on coaching training next year. But it's not insignificant. And so I see that as an opportunity. I think there is, there's an opportunity to almost like, but I think a different model than it's being done today, like a different business model, which is around assessments. Like, to me, I kind of hate the current way that most assessments are structured, where it's like you go and you pay, you know, $5,000 to go get certified and you know, any number of these types of assessments. And then it's like from then on, you basically, you know, pay for every assessment that you do. Like, I think there's a bunch of opportunities to just create like a membership where, you know, you basically create a whole bunch of different assessments and then rather than like charge, I bunch of different, I'm a huge fan of a book called Seven Powers, which basically talks about like, you know, sustainable competitive advantage and how to build moats. And so as I think a lot about the coaching business, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about counter positioning, which is like, how can you ultimately come to the market with a very different, with a very similar offering, but with a unique business model that's at a distinct advantage that makes it difficult for the incumbents to try to match because it cannibalizes their existing business.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Is there, we're at the end of the year, you talked about 2020 and how it sort of how it was unique for you. How did you go about, I know you built something for this recently, and I'd be excited to hear about your process. How does someone go about turning the page, right? Like 2021, ideally it ends up being a completely different year than what we just experienced in lots of different ways, right? If you have the opportunity to reflect, and hopefully you're sitting comfortable in your home right now listening to this, and everyone is feeling good around you and safe and healthy, what is the process to sort of get a great new leaf turned and to do, you know, to make sure that your next year is really excellent?
Yeah. So I just went on a 4-day sort of 2021 planning session. I also, I'm not sure if you saw that, but I published annualreview.life at microsite. Which has been now downloaded thousands of times. Incredibly.
Great. Congratulations.
Thanks. And so basically the way that I do my annual sort of turn, like my annual reflection and turn the page on the year I follow a 5-stage process. And to me, the first two stages, the first is identifying key moments and milestones. So I literally map out a timeline. So I go back and I look at social media, my calendar, photos, and I basically construct at a very high level, basically January to December. I'm like, you know, really what happened this year?
Yeah.
And then the second phase is really like a look back. So it's examining, you know, my successes, where did I fall short, my health, relationships, main lessons and themes. And so it really, again, begins with a, with like a two-phased retrospective. And then the third phase is what I call like a current life assessment. So it's not too dissimilar to like from the, like, it's not too dissimilar from the Wheel of Life, where it's basically creating a number of grades like across or scoring or placing a value on these different dimensions of your life, just to create awareness as to like, okay, well, where am I right now?
Right.
And then once you've done that, those first three phases, then it's time to start to set the intentions for the next year. So the fourth phase is all about what I call intentions and goals. So it's going through like, you know, basically very, you know, few dozen questions in terms of like, you know, what's most important, what do you want to focus on, so on and so forth. And then the last phase is, you know, next steps and planning. So it's like, rather than like, oh, I'm going to go and set my New Year's resolution for A, B, C, and D, you've already done all the work to decide like, why is this important? Who do you want to become? And then it's like, what are the immediate next steps? Like, how do you plan? Who do you want to get you to help? Like, what resources do you need? Where do you want to be in 30 days? So it's basically helping you create a little bit more structure around taking those first steps to get that momentum.
Yeah, then that's it. Like, most people are actually going to quit along the process, right? So it's the more clarity that they have, the more they have the ability to do it and make sure that they get all the way through and actually get the results out of it.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. And a friend of mine, a super talented coach, his name's Sunil Arora. I sent him an early version of the site of annualreview.life. And he looked at it and said, wow, this is like a lot of work. Like, this is really going to take someone. And I said to him like, look, like it is a lot of work, right? Because if you like, you can do these, there's plenty of annual planning tools out there. But the point is like, it should be a lot of work if you want to extract, you know, the earnings and be able to apply them to how you want to show up and who you want to become in the next year.
Okay. One, I know you have to go in literally 2 minutes and I want to be respectful of that. So just tell me how you find a coach. If someone is looking for one, often they have difficulty doing this. Almost everybody does. They ask for a referral or some other thing like that. And then how can you tell if your coach is good?
Yeah. I think we could spend an hour just unpacking those two questions. I would say, you know, I think it all depends on the person. I think if you're running in entrepreneurship circles, like if you're a founder, I think a lot of it right now is word of mouth. I think there's a variety of new kinds of organizations that are popping up, like Prismatico, that's doing like a lot of coaching matching.
I'll have Nina on the show soon.
Yeah. And so I think that's, you know, that's an example where they become more of like a matchmaker. So I think that's definitely one. I think the other is there's going to be established brands in the space, like a Reboot, like an Evolution. There's brand recognition. You go to one of them. And then the other is just like word of mouth, at least today. Right. And I think like in terms of how do you find some, I think I always recommend like see what's online about them, right? Yeah. Like, who are they? What drives them? Why did they get into coaching? I mean, I even created an entrepreneur's guide to finding a coach. I don't know if you ever saw that. It's like a 100-page slideshare, and it goes into this process in quite a bit of detail. I wish we had time to unpack it all. And then I think in terms of like, at least for me, how I think about, it's funny because my coaching session is actually right now, but I think like for me, the question I always ask myself when I am being coached and whether I'm getting value from it, how do I know it's working? I think there's two. Is like, one, am I moving the ball forward on the things that are most important?
Right.
Like, am I really bringing to life the things that I want to see exist?
Yeah.
And then so that's sort of the first piece. So it's just progress on the things that are most important to me. And then I think the other is like, am I building new skills? Like, am I able to do more as a result of this relationship? Like, am I building internal capabilities myself? So I'd say those are the, at least for me, that's how I evaluate it.
Schlaf, thank you so much for being on our show. It was great chatting with you in this capacity, and enjoy your coaching call.
Thanks. Happy holidays. I love you, man.
Happy New Year. I love you too. Take care.